Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
A federal bank examiner has taken 2,200 pages to explain what a lot of people already knew, that the guys who were running Lehman Brothers a year and a half ago were playing fast and loose with the facts. The official Lehman postmortem is out. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, a mutual life insurance company owned by its members and policyholders. Learn more at massmutual.com/mutuality. And by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here, everybody. It is a Friday afternoon. This one is the 12th of March. In the 18 months or so since it went under, Lehman Brothers has come to symbolize all that was wrong with Wall Street. Wretched excess, hubris, and greed, and a sense that the regular rules just didn't apply. Them, of course, is fighting words, but the report out today from a federal bank examiner backs them up. It says negligence and even fiddling with the books by Lehman executives contributed to its demise. As I mentioned, the report runs well over 2,000 pages, but if I could recommend just a single section to you, it would be Volume 3, about a nifty piece of accounting chicanery called Repo 105. Our New York Bureau Chief Amy Scott explains.
Before we get to Repo 105, let's talk about the plain old repo. It stands for Repurchase Agreement, and it's a common way that Wall Street firms fund their business. They lend securities in exchange for cash with an agreement to repurchase those securities, often the next day.
Securities lending arrangements are common. They're almost like breathing for brokerage firms.
Jack Suzelski publishes the Analyst's Accounting Observer. He says there's nothing wrong with repos.
It's when you're stretching the truth to get to a certain kind of accounting treatment that you've got something to worry about.
And that brings us to Repo 105. The bankruptcy examiner's report says Lehman dreamed up a repurchase agreement with a twist. By putting up securities worth 105% of the cash it received, Lehman could call the transaction a sale rather than a regular repo, which is more like a loan. And why would it want to do that?
If you've called it a sale, it's not on your balance sheet anymore.
And back in 2007 and 8, Lehman Brothers' balance sheet was under a lot of scrutiny. Analysts and investors were worried the firm had taken on too much debt. Christopher Whalen is with Institutional Risk Analytics. He says Lehman's accounting gimmick made it look like the firm was addressing those concerns.
The net effect was to hide debt. And they were using the same techniques as Enron and WorldCom to falsify their assets.
The report says Lehman managed to hide $50 billion worth of debt in 2008. A lawyer for former CEO Dick Fuld says he didn't know what those transactions were, but other executives clearly did. In an email, one of them referred to the accounting tricks as another drug we are on. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
One of the difficult but mostly positive lessons that Americans have learned from the credit crisis is that we ought to be saving more. The Federal Reserve keeps track of how much we collectively owe, and it says that last year, for the first time since 1945, household debt actually fell. So we are all saving and skimping, right? Nah, turns out we actually have less debt because we're walking away from it. From Washington, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer explains.
The Federal Reserve says the total debt of U.S. households shrank more than 1.5% last year, but the debt wasn't paid off. The banks wrote it off as a loss, and the Fed recorded lower consumer debt levels.
People are, in some sense, walking away from their properties and, in some sense, reducing their debt loads through jingle mail.
Kerry Leahy is an economist at Decision Economics.
It means you leave the keys in the mailbox and then walk away from your property.
That's essentially what Christopher Boettcher did. He declared bankruptcy almost 2 years ago. The financial crisis buffeted Boettcher on a number of fronts. He appraises houses in northern Minnesota. His income went from $250,000 in 2004 to $10,000 last year. Now he has a second job, and with no more debt, Boettcher and his wife are starting to spend again.
There's definitely some expenses we've done in the last, say, 6 months that we would not have done if it hadn't been for having that weight lifted off of us.
Betcher just bought his wife a $900 ring for their anniversary, but he's going to pay it off in 6 months to avoid interest. He doesn't use credit cards anymore. Brian Bethune is seeing that a lot. He's an economist at IHS Global Insight. Bethune says debt-free consumers are starting to spend, but they're not loading up the plastic.
It's mainly cash and debit cards that they're using, so that's okay. I mean, it still rings the cash registers insofar as the retailers and restaurants, and they'll take it.
But cash will only take the economy so far. You're not going to put a house on your debit card. Bethune says both banks and consumers will have to get comfortable with credit again for the economy to recover fully. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
London's main stock index, the FTSE, lost 0.2% today, but really, who cares? A survey out today called the Global Financial Centers Index shows the British capital is no longer the world's leading financial center. New York shares the top spot. So we asked Marketplace's Stephen Beard what the heck happened.
London's finance industry has been called the jewel in the crown of Britain's economy, a major employer, exporter and source of tax revenue. So today's news has come as a shock.
Well, it's a bit of a jolt. We've been very used to being the top dog financially for about the last 300 years.
Rob McIver of the Association for Financial Markets says there's no doubt why London's been losing its appeal.
The big point that comes through from the findings of the research is actually that people are concerned about the tax and regulatory environment in London.
The British government has hiked the top rate of income tax to 50% and slapped a 50% tax on all bankers' bonuses. The banks are threatened with much tougher regulation, and not just from the UK authorities. Stuart Fraser is head of policy for the London Financial Centre, the City as it's known.
We've got the added layer of European regulation, which could well affect the competitiveness of the city.
The European Union's planning new rules to curb private equity and hedge funds, and there's even talk of banning some of the financial products used to speculate against Greek government debt.
We have extra layers of possible restraints, which New York doesn't have.
But a US crackdown is also planned, and while London has stumbled, New York isn't flourishing. According to the Global Financial Centres Index, it's merely holding its own, while Asian financial centres are growing fast. Economist Andrew Hilton.
There's nothing that New York or London or Western Europe can do to keep that business if indeed people really want to go for the Asian dollar.
And they do. In this year's index, Hong Kong surpassed both London and New York as the top place for insurance. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
In what we all know is the real world financial center, stocks kind of moved sideways. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. This was, to be completely honest with you, not such an exciting week in the world of business and the economy. But then last night, the news gods smiled on us, and as Amy Scott explained, that report on Lehman Brothers landed. Here to dissect and discuss on our weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond are John Carney from ClusterStock.com. Also, Heidi Moore from The Big Money. Good to talk to you both again.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
Thanks for having me.
I'm going to have to choose between you to see who wants the first whack at this Lehman Brothers thing. So the winner today is going to be Heidi. We haven't heard from you in a while.
Pick me.
Yeah, that's right. Any surprise at all that Lehman Brothers was basically being naughty?
I think largely, directionally, we already knew a lot of this. But it also absolves a lot of other people who were blamed for Lehman's collapse and had nothing to do with it, like short sellers like Goldman Sachs, like Ken Lewis, like Hank Paulson. And it really puts the blame squarely on those Lehman leaders who decided to play fast and loose with accounting.
John Carney, is anybody going to jail because of this?
Jeff Skilling is still appealing his conviction for Enron, so mm-hmm. Who knows whether or not any of this will hold up. But I do think that a lot of what went on in Lehman that was revealed from this report is evil, and I think there will be criminal prosecutions arising from it.
Heidi, what do you think? Anybody going to jail?
I think some people might, but I don't think it'll be Dick Fuld, and I don't think it'll be...
The former CEO.
The former CEO, exactly, or some of the people that you might think, because a lot of this was done in such a spirit that people were working together to try to keep this firm alive. And they were crossing some lines, but they weren't doing anything technically illegal. What was illegal, or could be argued it was illegal, was the non-disclosure. And so what they actually did wasn't wrong. So it's going to be a long, drawn-out kind of case.
Well, that's the oldest cliche, though, isn't it? That it's the cover-up that gets you in trouble rather than the actual act. And in this case, that's probably true, that they could have gotten away with doing a lot of the dodgy accounting moves that they were doing if they were upfront about how they were doing it. The failure to tell people about it was shocking. Heidi said this wasn't very surprising. Let me just say, I was shocked at the level of what looks like malfeasance and dishonesty.
Any chance you're being naive here, John? I mean, that's a funny question, but in all seriousness,
I thought maybe that they were marking up their assets a little too much, you know, not taking the kind of write-downs they were. In fact, they were taking tens of billions of dollars of assets that should have been on their books and hiding them. That shocked me.
Any chance in the world, Heidi, that this turns into some push for real regulation now that people see in black and white what Wall Street was doing?
I think it's interesting that we've seen it in this detail. You rarely get this insight, but I don't think that it will result in regulation necessarily because it was so specific to Lehman, and no one has ever used these accounting tricks before.
All right, wait a second. First of all, how do we know nobody's ever used these accounting tricks before?
They actually said that. I mean, some of the Lehman executives said we're acting way out of the boundaries of the rest of the street. So it wasn't that no one had ever used them, but that they were so, so rare.
John, do you really think nobody else on Wall Street is doing this kind of stuff?
I would say that probably no one is doing particularly this one thing that Lehman was doing. But what really frightened me about this is here was a scam that we had no idea even was possible.
Right.
Who knows how many other new ways are out there getting the blessings of auditors that we don't know about. So it's reopened for me the possibility that the banks are much less healthy than any of us know, despite what they're telling the regulators and despite what they're telling their investors.
Heidi, what do you think of that?
I would agree. There were so many people that were misled about what was going on at Lehman that it really does give you pause about the freedom that banks have to tell us what's really going on. And I think it should focus our attention and Washington's attention on kind of a systematic problem right now where banks are still overvaluing their assets. That's still happening, but we have no idea of the scale, and it probably could be bigger than we picture. But do we really want to know that? I mean, what would that do? It would destroy the banks again.
And if that whole conversation was not enough, there is a link to the entire report, 2,200 pages of it, on our website, marketplace.org. John Carney, he writes for ClusterStock.com. Heidi Moore, she's a contributing writer at The Big Money. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you, Kai.
Thanks a lot.
An enormous lead smelter is set to reopen later this month in central China. It and a series of others across the country were shut down last summer. Thousands of children had been found with dangerously high levels of lead in their blood. At the time, the government in Beijing promised compensation to the victims and punishment for the offenders. We sent Marketplace's Scott Tong to Hunan Province to see how that's working out.
6 months ago, in the Wugang district of Hunan, parents were mad. 1,300 local kids were found with significant lead in their blood from an illegal smelting plant that spewed soot in the air, dumped heavy metal waste in the groundwater. At the time, the parents blocked the main road. They flipped a police car, tore off the door to the local police station, and flung it in the river. Now, though, the fight seems to have gone out of the villagers. Parent Hu Xianghong's 2-year-old son is one of the sickest.
The government gave us about $100, paid for one treatment, and that's it. The drugs are too expensive, so he's not taking any more.
Hu says her toddler has a cold all the time. He doesn't eat much these days. Neighboring villager Qu Shunping also notices a difference in his son.
He doesn't want to study. Before, his grades were good, but now he's not motivated.
For these children, the impact of lead exposure may have just begun. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control links lead poisoning to brain damage and compromised motor and cognitive functions. Even mild exposure can have lasting effect on attention span and IQ. That's according to the National Institutes of Health in the U.S. But the local Wugang government argues the kids have been treated and they're healthy. Deputy Mayor Lei Jiaming.
Lead can be eliminated from the body. It's not like what you said, that it's a lifetime thing. Children have recovered well. We now have good social order.
Political scientist Dali Yang at the University of Chicago says local Chinese officials often downplay incidents to protect their future prospects in the Communist Party. He says Chinese officials often get promoted based on local economic growth and based on social stability.
There is very little tolerance for instabilities, and as a result, officials really take excessive measures to try to keep the appearance of stability.
There have been at least 5 industrial lead scandals in China since last summer. Farmers in Hunan say the government ignores their concerns, and then violators get off light. At the offending smelting plant, no one answers a knock at the metal gate. It's been shut down since August. Back then, the boss was said to be on the run. But now, villagers say he's back in the streets, behind the wheel of his SUV with no license plates, hobnobbing with politicians.
I saw the boss, saw him with my own eyes. He owns several coal mines. Did they jail him? No. The government protects him.
We asked government spokesman Lei Jiaming if the boss is indeed walking free.
We are following the legal procedure in accordance with the law. The boss is cooperating with the government.
There are 7 village people who have been locked up. Not the operators of the plant, but parents who protested last summer. Each was fined about $2,000 to get released, about 1 year's salary in these parts. One parent, Li Yuelun, remains behind bars, says his grandfather.
We don't have the money. I was detained too. I went to the township 3 times to demand answers about the smelter. I got nothing, so I kicked the gate. Then they locked me up.
If the government jailed the villagers to intimidate the masses, it may be working. Local parent Hu Xianghong has no more plans for civil disobedience.
The government detained people. We regular people dare not say anything now. We just listen to whatever they say.
As we leave, one father promises to update us on what happens next, if anything does. In Hunan, central China, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Staff researcher Cecilia Chen contributed to that story for us. Coming up, he's a tall, slender redhead available for nighttime work. Why the hardest working man in showbiz is working so hard. But first, let's do the numbers. Man, it was dead calm at the finish on Wall Street today. The Dow Industrials finished up a 10%, 12 points, closed at 10,624. The NASDAQ traded flat to just slightly lower, closed at 2367. The S&P 500 dipped a quarter point, less than a 10%, ended at 1149. For the week, the Dow rose 0.6%. The NASDAQ picked up 1.8%. The S&P 500 snuck up 1%. News from the Census Bureau that the American consumer is still shopping a little bit helped retailers. Nordstrom bagged a 2.25% gain. Saks sashayed up more than 2.5%. Try saying that 10 times fast. Saks sashayed up. Macy's rang up 3.25% today. The 10-year T-note rose. When that happens, the yield goes down. Today it fell to 3.7%, and you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. And by American Public Media, announcing Krista Tippett's new book, Einstein's God, Conversations about Science and the Human Spirit, available in bookstores now. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on podcasts. You'll find Marketplace, The Morning Report, Marketplace Money, and more, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve reports on industrial production for February. It's time to get counted. In Phoenix, the Census Bureau kicks off its 2010 mailing. Be sure to send that form back, or else it costs Uncle Sam $57 to send a census taker to chase you down. And don't be late to work. We spring forward on Sunday. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know, for all the troubles the American automobile industry is having, Detroit can count its lucky stars for at least one thing. It never had anything to do with the Yugo. In the long, long history of automotive lemons, nothing was quite as sour. This 1980s vintage review gives you just a taste of how bad that car really was.
Attention to detail leaves something to be desired. Listen to the sound of this dash light dimmer.
And yet somehow, and for some reason, Americans loved it, at least for a while. Historian Jason Viewick has a new book out about the Yugo. It is subtitled The Rise and Fall of the Worst Car in History. Jason, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
How did it come to pass that this car wound up in the United States? It's not your, you know, V8 gas-guzzling muscle car, that's for sure.
Well, there were really three factors that brought the Yugo to the United States. One was that in the 1980s, the Japanese and American manufacturers completely vacated the very low end of the market. Low-cost cars were simply not profitable. The second thing was Yugoslavia itself. It was an independent communist country that the United States wanted to support. It deprived the Soviets of the Mediterranean Sea and Mediterranean ports. So we tried to bring over Yugoslav goods and aid the government in any way. I mean, the Yugo wasn't paid with taxes, but our ambassador drove around Belgrade in a yellow Yugo with little American flags on the hoods. And then a third, there was Malcolm Bricklin. He's this phenomenal entrepreneur, and he's great at starting businesses, getting people excited, getting the press excited. He founded Subaru of America and then moved on to a Canadian car, which failed miserably. So he was known for these great early successes and then catastrophic failures. And that was one of the reasons the Yugo came over. It was the next Bricklin venture.
What was it as that car got here? I mean, people went bananas for this thing.
Absolutely. It opened in about 50 dealers, and about 1,050 cars were sold in a single day. There were lines at some dealerships 10 deep. People were buying cars sight unseen, and they called it Yugomania, believe it or not.
And the sticker price was how much?
$3,990.
And you got for that what? You got something that had wheels, a motor, and not too much else.
It didn't even have a glove box. It was just a basic car. It was designed in the 70s and then brought to the United States in 85. So the day it came here, it was already dated technology trying to compete with Japanese cars.
The car comes, it sells bunches and bunches that first year, and then Consumer Reports gets its hands on one, right?
It was in February 1986 that Consumer Reports came out, and they put the car through the ringer. And those were the days when it was the car buying Bible. And they panned the Yugo. They put it on the cover. A big Peterbilt tractor was bearing down on it. The driver was cringing in fear. And then at the very end of the article, it said it was better to buy a good used car than a new Yugo.
Was it actually, as your title says, the worst car ever?
No. And what I examine is the myth of the Yugo. I think it was probably the worst car of the 80s, certainly. But if it passed safety and emissions tests, it was a relatively decent car. There are many cars in developing countries that used to be sold around the world, but they certainly couldn't be sold in the United States. They couldn't pass these very expensive and rigorous emissions and safety tests. So the fact that the Yugo was sold here means it was a relatively decent car.
And those cars from some of the developing economies, like I'm thinking of Tata in India and then the Dongfeng from China. I mean, did this pave the way at all? Did the Yugo pave the way at all?
I don't know. And I really hope people from Tata will look at my book and look at the Yugo lessons, because I really don't want Tata to go down the same road. And I see a lot of those same things developing, you know, data technology, cheapest car in America. A lot of things that happen with Yugo could happen with Nano. And I really don't want to see that happen. I like to see small cars make it in America and Spartan cars really carve out a niche.
Jason Viewick is an assistant professor of modern European history at Bridgewater College. That's in Virginia. He writes books, too. His most recent is called The Yugo, The Rise and Fall of the Worst Car in History. Jason, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Conan O'Brien's clearly not the sit around the house and take it easy type. The former Tonight Show host is contractually obliged not to be on television for the next couple of months, so he is taking his show on the road. He's announced a 30-city stand-up tour, officially called the Legally Prohibited from Being Funny on Television Tour. It starts next month in Eugene, Oregon. But it's not like O'Brien has to work, so why is he? Here's Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson.
When Conan O'Brien left The Tonight Show in January, he made clear that he wouldn't be spending his time on the golf course.
And if our next gig is doing a show in a 7-Eleven parking lot, we will find a way to make it fun. We really will. I have no problems. I don't want to do it in a 7-Eleven parking lot.
Instead, O'Brien, his sidekick Andy Richter, and some of his old band will hit venues from the Sacramento Memorial Auditorium to Radio City Music Hall here in New York.
You know, he's a performer, and performers love performing, and if he can't do television, this is probably the next best thing.
Stu Golfman is a Hollywood agent for a long list of well-known comics. He says all comedians crave attention, but he says this tour might have another benefit for O'Brien.
You know, it's not only going to be him doing live appearances, stuff is going to get leaked onto the internet, and it'll be a chance for him to, you know, keep himself on the eyes of, you know, many people online as well.
Just in case he needs a fan base to follow him back to TV if and when he returns to late night. But what exactly will people be watching him do at these live shows? Variety TV critic Brian Lowry says the whole thing sounds risky to him.
Things don't always translate directly into that kind of space. He's not a stand-up comic, per se. I mean, he really is, by training, a talk show host.
And O'Brien still has the PR entourage to prove it. It took me four layers of publicists and agents to get to the one who could tell me that Conan O'Brien is not doing any interviews about his tour. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, a very quick addendum to the news about Lehman Brothers. John Carney touched on it earlier in the wrap, but it is worth explaining for just a second that all of the creative accounting that Lehman Brothers was doing, its accounting firm knew all about it and didn't say anything. Negligent is the word the report used to characterize Ernst & Young's behavior. No word from them yet today on what they happen to think of that report. And on this Friday afternoon, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 12 points, a tenth percent. The NASDAQ traded basically flat. The S&P 500 dipped a quarter point, less than a tenth of 1%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is a guy named J.J. Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, when is a tip not really a tip? How about when you don't have a choice?
Even when the waiter forgets our order, the barber butchers our bangs, and the cab driver hits several cats, we still tip at least the minimum.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend. We are back here Monday afternoon.
American Public Media.